This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Great Dismal Swamp is a mucky wetland that stretches for thousands of acres across the northeastern corner of North Carolina and on into Virginia. This is not a place where you want to take a hike. We're talking swarms of mosquitoes, venomous snakes, hulking bears, not a pleasant place. But at one point, this swamp was a refuge for runaway slaves. For more than a century before the Civil War, escaped slaves used the thick and shadowy brush of the swamp as a hideout. They formed what are called maroon communities. My guest today has been exploring and excavating the swampland for more than a decade. Dan Sayers is an archaeologist and a professor of anthropology at American University. He authored the book, A Desolate Place for a Defiant People, and Dan Sayers joins us now. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
Tell us more about the landscape of the Great Dismal Swamp.
Oh, the landscape. It's, it's certainly an experience to walk through it, to march through it. It's very, first of all, there's all the sort of almost legendary standing water, very dark brown, but that water stands over this sort of real thick peat layer, which is just sort of spongy and mucky even. The trees are, a variety of species, but they're very thick in terms of, how they're spaced. It's very, very dense forest. And then basically at the ground level, there's the vines, there's the brush, there's all sorts of things growing. It's a very lively place, and certainly in that sense. And it's also very sort of different depending on the seasons. So summer, which is my more recent experiences with my work, summer months are for humans anyway, pretty brutal, very hot, humid, beyond hot and humid, frankly. But in the winter, it's a little different in the fall. So it's like a lot of places in the normal landscape where things change with the seasons. But it's very alive. That's certainly one way to think of it.
It is alive. Was it much alive and used by humans, native populations before the Europeans got here?
It was. That's the thing. The archaeology, especially when you're talking about sort of before Europeans, archaeologies are one of our main means of even understanding or having any kind of knowledge of that deeper past. And so archaeology has been pretty limited in the immediate Dismal Swamp area. But what we've been able to find within the swamp shows that for thousands of years, Native Americans at least exploited the swamp. And based on some of the things we found, certainly occupied various areas of it. Yeah.
All right, so tell us about these maroon communities, enslaved people who made their way off the plantation and into this swamp. Who were they?
Well, they were, in modern terms, they were certainly radical, to put it simply. These were people among the enslaved populations of that mid-Atlantic region who had had enough of the abuse and the oppression of that system, notoriously oppressive. And, they found this amazingly huge landscape right there in the heart of the mid-Atlantic, the Dismal Swamp, that was largely untouched by European development. And that kind of thing. So they took advantage of that. There was no one really claiming it, at least up until around 1800. No one was really kind of keeping an eye on it. So these sort of radical have had enough enslaved people made themselves unenslaved. It was really ingenious, taking advantage of this sort of remote landscape in the heart of colonial development. They made it work by going out there and leaving that world largely, and I emphasize largely, behind.
How big did the community get? I mean, was it a community or was it a way station for people to make their way into more hospitable territory?
Well, kind of think of it as two threads. Both are in a sense, correct. The limited documentary evidence we have does suggest that, especially after the 1820s, 30s, up to the Emancipation Proclamation, people that were fleeing or escaping conditions of enslavement did use the swamp as sort of a way to get through several hundred or at least tens of miles anyway within this remote place and then head to parts north or somewhere else. On the other hand, you had these maroons who permanently settled it, and they found these locations that were very comparatively anyway hospitable for settlement. And we're talking potentially based on what I found and certainly what's at least sort of mentioned in some ways in the documents, potentially thousands of these maroons that lived in the Dismal.
And what did that settlement look like? What did life look like for those who had actually developed a community in this place?
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing to, I suppose, make clear is at least the evidence that, that I've found and then my interpretation of it suggests that basically right around the time of the settlement of Jamestown, around 1607, not too long after that, the first people that were kind of alienated from their world already, Native Americans through the colonial sort of settlement and usurpation of their lands and traditional places, some number came into the swamp and occupied it. And then a little bit later, in the probably in the 1660s to 1680s, we start seeing the influx of African-born or African-American Maroons. And they form these communities, not only with Native Americans most likely, but then with increasing numbers as the years and decades went on, as enslavement sort of really sunk into the region. So the what we're looking at is to explain the lay of the land, you have this huge swamp. And at the time, that is to say between 1607 up to the Civil War, this was like 2,000 square miles. It was a huge, huge place. And so what you had was, yes, it was a big swamp, but you had these areas of dry ground that were very much settleable, if that's a word. So you're looking at sort of, to start with, a meta community, right? So you have a bunch of different groups living in these space, you know, just sort of randomly located dry ground areas. And no doubt, at least indirectly, but often directly, they interrelated. They probably exchanged things and so on. So you probably, that's where these thousands of people potentially are. They're spread out across the swamp in these dry ground sort of areas. If you start talking about the specific areas, then we're looking at, just think of a village is probably the way to imagine it. You know, and these were people that were building cabins, and at least the evidence we have, it's raised cabins. So they're a foot, foot and a half off the ground, probably on posts. And so these cabins are clustered in these dry areas, sort of probably, I've argued, along kin lines, that is to say families clustering together or extended families. You probably had this sort of, you know, relatively egalitarian approach to community living. There were different ranks and different sort of things people did for the community, but they all kind of worked together. It was a self-reliance ethos that certainly dominated.
Did slave owners know about this place and suspect that this is where some of their slaves were running away?
They sure did, yeah. That's sort of almost one of the main sort of insights we get from that long stretch of time from the period documents. It's newspaper ads, for example, where a particular slave owner puts out an ad for somebody who ran away and is probably heading for the Dismal Swamp or last seen around the Dismal Swamp, that kind of thing. So, and there's also just discussions in general. You can very much sense it, that the swamp itself was just this place that the slaveocracy feared. They loathed it. They knew people were going in there and staying.
Was there any contact or commerce with, you know, the world outside the swamp, or was it all self-contained?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, that's one of the more interesting aspects, in a sense, of the archaeology out there. One of the things that I sort of developed in my mind, even before I moved any dirt, was that in the deep interior of the swamp, which was most of that 2,000 square miles, by the way, these communities, they were going out there for a reason, and that was to get out of that wider world. They didn't go out there necessarily to say, oh, a week later they want to go back and say hi to someone or get some stuff from the local mercantile shop or whatever. They were really saying goodbye in a very resistance-dominated fashion to that outside world. So one of the things that goes along with this, if true, is that you expect there to not be that much in the way of mass-produced outside world materials, stuff that's very typical for historical sites. You know, it's the mass-produced plates and ceramics. It's the glass vessels to hold the wine, the whiskey, whatever it might be, silverware, iron objects, all that stuff. We just weren't expecting too much of that like you expect at a typical site. And interestingly enough, in the interior sites we've looked at, we found very little of this outside world material. When I say little, I mean if I basically about 1-4% of the entire range of stuff, archaeological materials I found for one of these interior sites, 1-4% is about how much we're talking about in terms of that outside world stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's just a very fascinating part of it. It's a total direct communication of this community ethos and this purpose for going out there. It's to say forget it to that outside world. What were they using instead? They were using anything that they could find in the swamp. So probably 90% of what they used was made from the organic stuff around them, the trees, the plants, and so on. But very interestingly, some amount of what they used was anciently made and deposited material culture from Native Americans. So Native Americans, hundreds and thousands of years before Maroons and others who lived in these interior communities, they had gone out in the swamp and they had left behind materials, and these historic Maroons and others were picking this stuff out of the ground and reworking it, reusing it. So it's a very interesting and unique sort of range of artifacts and approach to living, at least in my experience in doing archaeology.
Was there any sense that word of this place got out to other communities that were being exploited and used by the colonialist empire, and became aspirational? There was something about the world of the Great Dismal Swamp that was either mythical or aspirational for people enslaved in outside communities?
Well, I think, the evidence that people kept coming in, that and our evidence suggests that these were multi-generational communities that lasted upwards of 250 years, that alone shows that word was kind of getting out in a way, one way or another. Think grapevine, think just stuff that when you're in the know, you hear about it. And so they were inspiring people to join, and that kind of kept people coming in. But I think beyond that, the discussions of the Dismal Swamp Maroons and the resistance they represented were, the abolitionists, for example, you see a decent amount of discussion of the Maroons and how they represent the Maroons of the Dismal. Not only are groups to be proud of, they would have said, but also represent sort of, hey, look, this is how bad slavery is. And so I think it often inspired people to be thinking about the bigger sort of picture of this whole systemic enslavement and what was wrong with it, for sure.
What happens to those communities after the Civil War ends?
Well, that is one of the great mysteries. Part of what we've been trying to do, certainly since I started, but in more recent years for sure, with help with the National Endowment for the Humanities grant, was to try to locate people today who have family or community stories about the swamp, but certainly we are interested in any that might share about their Maroon past within their family. And so far, we haven't heard from too many, really any people that have that specific kind of story, the sort of Maroon past in their families or communities, and that's understandable. This is guarded. I imagine this is fairly guarded history, not the stuff necessarily people want to tell everyone about for a variety of family and community reasons. And so I'm just hoping. I'm hoping one day that we can hear some more or hear some stories and get a sense of what happened after particularly Emancipation Proclamation. Related to that question, what I have found, at least inside the swamp at these sites, is not much evidence for these communities lasting past the 1860s. So that would be simple stuff like finding artifacts that date to 1870 or 80, that kind of thing. And I haven't found much. It doesn't mean it's not out there, but right now the evidence that I have suggests that, around the Civil War, these communities finally just disbanded and either came out of the swamp or things changed so dramatically that we have to realign our sort of research perspective to see what they're doing out there.
I understand you were exploring the swamp when somebody tells you about some islands down in North Carolina. Tell us about that revelation.
Well, I started in the field work in the – well, let's make it clear here that where I'm working is the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Great Dismal Swamp National Wildlife Refuge. And with the permission of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I was able to begin this field work, this archaeological field work. And that was in the fall of 2003. And so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has always been, very supportive of the work. That's for sure. But those folks that I was talking to early on at the refuge office and so on, who work in the Dismal, I would tell them what I was interested in, and for some reason the way I was conveying it, dry ground, whatever I was saying at the time, they were like, okay, good luck, all the best to you to find areas of dry ground. And so I spent 3-4 months. It's a needle in a haystack kind of moment. I'm just out in a 190-square-mile refuge trying to find places in the interior away from pre-Civil War canals that I might find a hill, which is how they used to describe the residence areas or the landforms Maroons lived on. And when I think hill, I think of, something like twice the size of your standard dorm room or something like that, Yeah. Not too big. I just basically looking for this very small landform out in the middle of the swamp. And for months, just no. And this was pretty tough survey work and so on because of that landscape I described earlier, very thick, You know, days where we went 200 or 300 feet in 8 hours. It was so thick. It was just one of these things that was kind of getting, oh no, am I not going to have good luck here and find some place to look at? And finally, it was about 4 months in. I was talking to one of the refuge people, and somehow what I said clicked at that point or whatever it was. But he said, oh, well, have you been to the islands down in North Carolina? And I said, that was a new word to me. Islands? And he's like, yeah. Like, no. So would you mind taking me? And he was very, very pleasant about it, said, of course. So a couple of days later, he takes me through, and we're walking through, 2,000 or so circuitous feet of 2 or 3 foot of water in the muck and all that. And I have a bum foot from a teenage accident. So I always look down at the ground when I'm walking to make sure I'm not stepping on uneven stuff. Anyway, so I'm sitting there looking in the water, looking for fallen sunk logs and all that. And so anyway, suddenly I'm kind of seeing my feet come out of water. Now I'm stepping on crunchy, dry leaves, you know. And I'm like, what the heck is this? So I'm looking around me, and all of a sudden, yeah, all in front of me is this basin. Mm-hmm. It looks like a standard sort of plot of woods, right, unlike the rest of the swamp we just walked through. And I'm like, oh, my, you know, this is fantastic. And so all I could really see at the moment was something that might be called a big hill, you know. But it was amazing. That first moment, just sort of, okay, people had to have been here. You know, this is what I've been looking for. Well, then Brian, who was the one who was showing me, he ends up taking me a couple hundred feet into the dry sort of woodsy part. And he's like, yeah, you know, it keeps continuing west there for quite a while, but we got to get back. I got to get back and do stuff so you can come back. Well, it took a couple days of figuring out, but this island ends up being like 20 acres in size.
Wow.
So not just a hill in my mind anyway, but it was a very good sized landform. And so you look at this whole thing, and 20 acres may not sound much to a farmer or somebody or a big landowner, but when you're in the middle of a swamp and suddenly there's 20 acres of beautiful dry ground, it is a lot. And certainly the experience of walking it and then thinking about how a community or a village might appear, you can see a lot of people living there.
So you got work left to be done, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a lifetime or more yeah. for hundreds of people here, no doubt. Not that hundreds will work there. But, I it's kind of gone in phases. And, the book that you mentioned, thanks, that came out not too long ago, last couple of years. And that sort of represents, in a sense, the end of phase one in a way. And now we've done enough work that I think the approach now for me is going to be sort of addressing specific kinds of questions, a little more specific than are people here, what kinds of sites do they have, and so on. I think we're past that, so I can start really getting into some detailed questions and seeking support for those more smaller scale, specific, sort of targeted research programs.
It's called A Desolate Place for a Defiant People. A desolate place, meaning you didn't name the place and you decided that is something that you just didn't have the right to do, unlike most archaeologists who would, you know, claim naming rights. You chose not to do that.
Well, you know, particularly I didn't want to name the sites, these islands and landforms out there. Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, you name a site and it sticks. And even, so my hope is that down the road we'll hear from people, we'll find that old diary or something that tells us what residents used to call these islands, whatever sites I'm looking at. So I've come up with non-name names, things mm-hmm. that I can refer to, but we can easily kind of forget the words, the names people gave
yeah,
to the
you're
sites,
leaving
yeah.
space for the names they gave it.
Yeah, and I think that's
your own. Yeah,
and I think it's very important to in any way we can to give the voices of these people, and that would be a small but important example. You know, anytime we can do that is certainly what we're trying to do.
Dan Sayers, keep us posted, and thank you so much for talking with us now.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
Dan Sayers, an archaeologist and professor of anthropology at American University, author of the book A Desolate Place for a Defiant People, tells the story of his years and research at the Great Dismal Swamp. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.